Welcome to Special Sauce, Serious Eats podcast about food and life. Every week on Special Sauce, we talk to some of the leading lights of American culture, food folks and non-food folks alike.
Chefs are like snowflakes. I mean, no two are alike. You know, the way people come to this profession, the way they develop their style, their palate, their knowledge base, their skill set. I like this sort of peripatetic nature of it. You know, you kind of assemble your own curriculum as you go from job to job, and often that means going all over the country or all over the world.
This week, we are privileged to have author Andrew Friedman. His new book, Chefs, Drugs, and Rock and Roll, chronicles the development of the chef culture in America from the late 60s to the present. To say Andrew is prolific would be a gross understatement. He has co-authored more than 24 chef cookbooks and memoirs. Not only that, he's a tennis freak who collaborated on the New York Times best-selling memoir, Breaking Back, with tennis star James Blake. Oh yeah, he somehow finds the time to post on his blog, Tokeland, and interview chefs on his podcast, Andrew Talks to Chefs. Welcome to Special Sauce, Andrew Friedman. It's so good to have you,
man. Thank you, Ed. I'm exhausted just listening to all that.
Yeah, well, you know, it is
impressive. How did I even find time to come here?
I know. How did you find time to come here? Well, there's so many
things. It's because of you. It's for you, Ed Levine.
But there's so many things I want to talk to you about.
Okay.
The book is extraordinary in its depth and breadth, and the way you try to weave a narrative, and quite successfully, I might add. That's not a very easy narrative to weave. But we're not going to get to that book quite yet.
Okay.
First, you're going to tell me about life at the Friedman table growing up.
The Friedman table, there was a Friedman table in one of the Friedman households.
Okay.
So my parents were divorced. When I was 4 or 5, I still remember the night my dad left. This is actually a funny food story. My parents had been fighting a lot. I do remember that. And my father said, kids, I'm leaving. Or I'm going. I didn't know what he meant. I didn't know he meant he was moving out.
Right.
And at the time, McDonald's had some kind of Neapolitan ice cream cone, like a vanilla chocolate strawberry cone. This would have been very early 70s. And I said, all right, well, before you go, can you take us for one of those McDonald's cones? And we put robes on over our pajamas. He took us to McDonald's. We had the cone. He brought us home and he left.
that's
a true story. I haven't even thought of that in years. So anyway, in my house, I lived with my mom primarily, and she was a single working mom, had no time or energy when she came home from a fairly demanding job. And as often as not, it was, you know, she'd drop a bag of Wendy's food on the table. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there was no culture of the table in that home. My dad remarried. My dad has since passed away. My stepmother, her name is Anna Maria. She was originally from Cuba and a really good home cook. And they had that table culture. So until I outgrew it when I was a teenager, you know, the divorce settlement was my dad had me Wednesday nights and overnight on Saturday. And Saturday night, we sat at the table and we had dinner.
Wow.
You know, the phone was not answered. And that's what it was. And it was very often Cuban food or vaguely Latina food, you know, garlicky shrimp and arroz con pollo. And that was my sort of other life.
That's a pretty tumultuous childhood you're talking about.
Yeah.
It must have offered a level of comfort, those Saturday night meals.
It's something that I really loved, and it's something that I sort of crave. And if I'm really honest, we don't have it as much as I'd like in my own home. We have 13-year-old twins. Yeah, we live in the burbs now. My wife's schedule and mine are both very erratic because of our work. She has a big corporate job in Soho, and I took an office in the city because I couldn't stand being in the suburbs all day, even though I'm writing. So it's hard. It's hard. We don't have it on a nightly basis. We have it maybe once or twice a week where we actually have a proper dinner, or where, if I'm really honest, Caitlin and I have the energy to actually enjoy cooking a real proper meal, as opposed to something that can be thrown together quickly.
So how did you get interested in food?
It was through restaurants.
Okay.
I've always loved restaurants.
Me too. I can remember every restaurant that my parents took us to, which was mostly the Chinese restaurant that we went to on Sundays, China Jade.
Okay.
But Ricky's and Cairo's for Italian food. This was in Long Island.
Yeah.
And I can remember every restaurant and even what I ordered.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Which is crazy because I'm not young, so that was a long time ago.
Well, I didn't know anything about food, honestly. And to this point, I always say this. I always say I'm a chef writer, not a food writer, even though I've done all these cookbooks. You know, I never worked in restaurants. When I was a kid, I was a busboy at Mexico Lindo Mexican restaurant in Coral Gables. That's the extent of my hospitality experience.
Wow.
But I always loved a well-run restaurant, a restaurant that kind of hummed, you know, that had the right energy.
And you felt, even as a kid, you felt that energy. And you.
Yeah, although I didn't, I ended up doing what I do now as it was an accident. But I always did enjoy that. Then I was in the film business. I worked for two film producers. That was my childhood dream.
This was out of college.
Right out of college. In fact, in college, I interned for Universal Pictures, and I interned for the late director Sidney Pollack's company.
Wow.
Yeah. And then right out of school, I got a job working for a pretty successful independent producer and spent several years with him and his partner. And even there was the culture of restaurants. You know, I remember they would sometimes take me to the Russian Tea Room back in the day for lunch and things like that.
Did you see Sidney Pollack or Woody Allen there?
No,
you must
I never.
Have.
No, I never did. I never did. I don't know that I saw anybody super famous there. But, I mean, I met a lot of people who would come through the office and... It was fun. It was exciting. But when I was in college in New York, I came to college in New York, and I used to very often, it's a little embarrassing now, but I used to go to the movies all the time over near Bloomingdale's, like the Cinema 123 and the Beekman, all those theaters.
In the 70s and 80s, those were the theaters.
They were big deal theaters. And at the after the movies, I would very often go to Serendipity with friends of mine for a frozen hot chocolate. It used to be a crush at the door. And I was directing college theater. And one night after a show, I was with this woman I was friends with and a friend of hers, my friend Kim and this woman, Julia. And we get in a cab to go down to Serendipity. I actually thought Serendipity was cool. I mean, that's the state of my life back then. But we got in a cab to go down there after one of the performances, and Julia says to me, "I understand you fancy yourself Mr. New York." And I said, "I do." And she said, "Well, I just want you to know that I'm Ms. New York." She was from like Framingham, Massachusetts. I was from Florida. I said, "Okay, you know, we'll see." So we get to Serendipity, Saturday night, totally packed, and we get to the podium. And just by virtue of my having left my name there so many times, the hostess says, "Mr. Friedman, we haven't seen you in weeks. Where have you been?"
And you go, this is gold.
And I turned to Julie and she says, "Touché." But I loved that feeling of being recognized in a restaurant in New York City. You know, as a kid from Miami, the Miami I grew up in is not the Miami of today.
Right.
I felt that was the coolest thing. And then I got out of the film business. I decided I was going to try to write prose. And I didn't know what to do to make a living. And I literally just thought, well, I could write copy, I guess. I didn't really even know what that meant. And through the New York Times, I got a job with what was at the time the top restaurant PR firm in New York City, a guy named David Kratz.
Oh, I remember David Kratz. And you even reference him in the book.
I interviewed him in the book. Well, David was the top restaurant PR guy for years. And I went to work for David. And all of a sudden, I was repping Alfred Portale at the Gotham Bar and Grill.
One of the seminal restaurants in New York.
Alfred,
that you wrote about it a lot in the book.
Yeah, I repped him. I represented a 24-year-old Marcus Samuelson the minute he was appointed at Aquavit. I represented Rocco DiSpirito, actually one restaurant before he got really famous at Union Pacific. Restaurant Associates was my client. So all of a sudden, I was... You know, we worked really hard in that office, and then we'd go to these restaurants for dinner, you know, and as a pack. It was a great time. I mean, it was great. I never liked doing PR, but I started to fall in love with being behind the curtain of restaurants. And, you know, these chefs became, you know, they became, most of my friends are not writers. Most of my friends are chefs.
Right.
So that's how it all started. And then Alfred Portale had taken his sweet time getting around to writing a cookbook, and because of the rapport we had, he asked me to write the Gotham Bar and Grill cookbook, which ended up doing, the reviews were great. We won the Julia Child Cookbook Award. We were up for the Beard Award for Best General Cookbook. And I thought, you know, this isn't the kind of writer I ever wanted to be, but at least maybe it's a way to be a working writer. Quit my job.
And working writers are, it's really a good thing to find out how to be a working writer.
It's hard. It took years to calibrate it, you know, to figure out, okay, I was also doing some freelance work. And you think, okay, they're going to pay me X. Well, you don't realize it might take 5 months for that $400 check to roll in.
Tell me about that. You know? I lived that life before Serious Eats.
Yeah.
It was the cash flow crunch life.
Yeah. So I learned how to deal with the staggered income. And, you know, it's 20 years later now, and I'm very lucky to have been doing it all that time.
So let's talk about then your first foray into writing this cookbook.
Sure.
What was the process like? First of all, were you interested just because it was a job, because you liked Alfred, you were friends with him, you thought he had something to say? Like, what was the impetus behind that?
So the true story, and I'll tell this as fast as I can, Alfred had met a bunch of literary agents and didn't like any of them. And David Kratz, the guy who had this agency, had been an attorney. David was really smart. And David's feeling was, outside of, you know, brain surgery, rocket science, whatever, basically, if you were smart, you could figure out how to do anything. So Alfred asked David if he would just agent his book, and David said, yeah. So one day, David comes over and drops the existing book proposal on my desk and says, I'm not happy with this proposal. I don't need to say who wrote it. I want you to rewrite it. And I took it home, and I literally, Ed, I swear to God, I did not own a single cookbook at this time.
Did you own How to Write a Book Proposal?
Nothing. No, but I mean, the proposal was written. I just felt like I was...
You were flying blind.
I just thought, well, I could, yeah, I know how to make this into something I'd want to read. So I did that, and we sold the book to Doubleday. And then I said to Alfred, look, I would really be honored to see this through, but I'm not going to campaign for this. You're my client. It's a conflict. I'm just saying it once. And he said, thank you very much. And then he hired another writer.
Wow.
And then like a year later, like 8 weeks shy of the deadline, he asked me to come by the Gotham one day. And he said, look, I the book's not what I want. It's due in 8 weeks. Do you think you could punch it up?
Punch it up.
And I said, and this is really dating myself, because they didn't just email me a file. He handed me the manuscript. And I lugged it home to my apartment on 8th Street. And I came back and I said, look, I don't have any cookbooks, but I think we need to start from scratch, not the recipes. I mean, honestly, I only knew how to write recipes because I had chef clients. And once in a while, we'd have to give a recipe to the New York Times. And so we proceeded to re-interview for all the chapter intros, all the headnotes or the intros to the individual recipes. It was fun. I mean, I would work a full day at work. And then maybe three nights a week, I'd walk. The Gotham was on my way home.
Right, because the Gotham's on 12th Street.
Yeah, I lived on 8th Street, and our office was on 20th Street.
So it was a very circumscribed world.
It was awesome. I was in my late 20s. I had the energy to do this. I would work a full day. I would go to the restaurant. We would interview, and then we'd go out. And that was the first time I'd really seen the way a chef at that level gets treated in a restaurant. You know, I jokingly say, like, why, Mr. Portali? You know, it was like a seduction. You know, I was just completely swept up in this whole thing. So David, the guy who owned the agency, said to me, it's fine with me if you do this, but you cannot do it on company time. So there were many days where I would work a full day, go interview Alfred, come back, not go home, come back to the office, write all night. And then across the street was the original Equinox. The very first Equinox was right across the street. I was a member there. I would, at 8 o'clock, go to Equinox, shower, shave. They had all the accoutrement there, like all the amenities.
Right.
Shower, shave, blow my hair dry, put the same suit back on, go get a ham and egg sandwich and a nice coffee and work a full day. I mean,
wow.
That's how I got that book done. It was crazy. But it was great. I was 28, 29, whatever. I mean, it was. I look back on that time really fondly.
Yeah.
You know?
I had things like that when I was in the music business, and you'd do what you could for money, and then I'd end up hanging out with jazz musicians.
Yeah.
And then doing whatever I was doing. And people say, wow, it sounds exhausting. And mostly What I remember was how great it felt.
Oh, yeah, it's exhilarating.
It's so exhilarating. Yeah. And I remember I used to manage this great jazz band called the Heath Brothers.
Uh-huh.
And Percy Heath, who was the bass player of the Modern Jazz Quartet, at Jimmy Heath's retirement concert, he came up to me and he said, "Do you regret all the time you spent with us?" And I said, "Regret it? It was one of the highlights of my life.
Totally.
I treasure those moments.
Totally. And I have to say, I didn't know this is what I was going to end up doing for a living. I just wanted to do a good job. I mean, honestly, who would have seen that coming? And it's weird. Something switched in my brain, and it actually serves me very poorly now. But I used to do really well under pressure. You know,
yeah.
That used to be people. I was kind of known as a guy, if you had a cookbook in need of a rescue, call me. Tight deadlines.
But what's interesting about it is you entered the world through what you're telling me is a cookbook doctoring job.
Basically, yeah. Although I would say that with the exception of the recipes, I rewrote the book.
And who tested those recipes? Had they already been tested?
It was the other writer. I don't really need to mention
it. Yeah, yeah. No, I'm just saying there was another person.
And I would have been incapable of doing that. I didn't have the qualification. Most people come to food writing, as you know. They come to it from cooking, not as writers.
Right.
And I didn't.
Yeah.
So when I quit my day job to do this full time, the first thing I did was went to what is now the ICC, but used to be the FCI, the French Culinary Institute, and I'd signed up for the La Technique program. So at least I would have a base cooking knowledge.
And so do you now test your own recipes, or did that enable you, or did it just give you a broader perspective on what you were writing about?
It enabled me to. I sometimes did it myself. I sometimes did, I did 3 cookbooks with Tom Valenti, a chef here in New York. We tested together. So I often tested with people. My strong preference now is I will happily pay for half of a recipe tester to not test. I hate recipe testing.
Got it. Okay. Yeah. That's interesting.
Yeah.
So you're all of a sudden thrown into this chef world.
Yeah.
You've written one cookbook. What intrigued you about the world of chefs in general? Like, what drew you to it?
You know, it's funny. I once in a while, I'll meet somebody new, and they'll gradually realize I have all these chefs in my life, and they'll be confused by that, you know? And this is kind of a dated reference, but I'll say, look at it this way. I'm Richie Cunningham, and they're all Arthur Fonzarelli, you know?
that's a Happy Days reference. He's showing his age.
We shouldn't be friends, but it works.
Right.
You know, I just find these guys fascinating. I think these men and women are totally fascinating. I find, first of all, from a subject matter point of view, so I also write about tennis, okay? Most tennis players' biographies at some point become the same, which is they're at an academy, they're hitting thousands of balls a day, they start flying around to tournaments, and that's your life.
Right.
You know, chefs are like snowflakes. They're and I don't mean it in the unfortunate political way people mean that. I mean, no two are alike. You know, the way people come to this profession, the way they develop their voice, as I like to call it, their style, their palate, their knowledge base, their skill set. I like this sort of peripatetic nature of it. You know, you kind of assemble your own curriculum as you go from job to job, and often that means going all over the country or all over the world. I also, you know, a lot of these, not all of them, but a lot of people, you know, the word misfit is in the subtitle of my book. You know, a lot of these people are people who kind of don't fit in anywhere else in the world, and kitchens sort of save them. And I am someone I have a fairly conservative personality. I'm a very careful person. And I find the sort of rough around the edges quality, the sort of unfiltered quality that a lot of these people have, I find it really appealing.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm very often drawn to, there's a guy in, he's opens the book that I just wrote. His name's Bruce Martyr. He's not very well known. He's not particularly well liked. He's not a social guy. He's a brilliant chef, and he's more important than he's ever been credited for. And when I went out to interview him when I was in L.A. doing my research, I was a little afraid of this guy. And we've become really good friends.
Yeah.
You know, my flight got canceled Friday night, and I stayed with him
this
and his wife.
This last Friday night, you were out doing promotion for the book.
For the book, I was in L.A. The last thing I was going to do was have dinner with Bruce and his wife. They live not far from the airport. And on the way to see him, my flight got canceled because we had a nor'easter back east. And they put me up. I spent the weekend at this guy's house.
Wow.
And I just, I don't know, part of me wants to kind of watch out for these people a little bit. You know, I feel like I get them. I think they feel like I get them. I think I'm a fairly empathic person.
Yeah.
And I key into these people. And I just kind of love them, you know? I do. And they've become a huge part of my life.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know how that sounds, probably very corny, but that's how it is.
One of the reasons, and I'm not half as, I know a fair number of chefs, as you know, not like you do. But what is fascinating is how they all connect the dots differently.
Yeah.
As you say, you use the snowflake metaphor.
Yeah.
But that's what's been interesting to me. And the other thing that's interesting to me, and you get into it in the book, which we will get to shortly, is the sort of high-low aspect of chefs' minds, chefs' thinking, and chefs' background.
Now, what do you mean by that?
So a lot of guys like Chris Bianco, right, came from a working-class background, but he's a poet. He's the poet. I call him the poet laureate of pizza.
Yeah, right.
And for a long time, as you wrote in the book, you know, chefs came from a pretty hard scrabble background.
A lot of them, yeah.
But then what happened is you started having people who had gotten their PhDs in chemistry
right.
at Berkeley becoming chefs. So all of a sudden you have this collision of classes and collision of cultures. And that's one of the things that I've always been intrigued by and what's drawn me. It's the same thing that drew me to jazz musicians.
Yeah, I get that.
Jazz musicians
sure.
had that same high-low thing,
yeah.
right? None of them were rich like rock stars, but they had so much accrued wisdom that I just loved hanging out with them.
Yeah. I just love how unfiltered a lot of these people are. And the thing you just mentioned is really kind of amazing that you could have a guy like Jeremiah Tower and who's mixing with all these like
right,
high school dropouts.
Who's the Jeremiah's most effete guy in the world.
And a Harvard graduate with an architecture degree and grew up with a lot of money traveling the world, you know. But even he felt this sort of, I think people who end up in kitchens very often feel out of place elsewhere. So that's interesting to me. The other fascinating, when you just said high-low, I thought you were going to go somewhere else, which is there's this book called White Heat, Marco Pierre White.
Great book.
Now, a lot of people listening to this maybe just know him as this TV personality. Marco was, I think, the youngest person ever to get 3 Michelin stars.
Yes, and famous for throwing a hotel pan of lasagna, I believe, at Mario Batali.
Risotto,
okay.
Yes, true. Yes, that's a true story.
Andrew is the only person in the world who could correct
me. I'm sorry, was that rude?
No,
well,
it was
you have
awesome.
You can edit it out.
No, it's awesome.
Here, I'll give you a different answer.
No.
Yes, lasagna.
No.
So, you know, he wrote this book, White Heat, years ago. And White Heat was revolutionary because there were these beautiful pictures of plated food like you'd see in a restaurant of that caliber. But then there were these like kind of black and white, gritty, dungeonous sort of kitchen shots, right? And Marco smoking a cigarette and you know, it kind of showed what was going on in the kitchen.
Right. The curtain was being pulled back.
Yes. But to me, what's fascinating, and when you said high-low, is the dichotomy between what goes on in the kitchen, between how physical the work is, between the stress of a service, and very often the circumstances of these people's lives. Again, you mentioned the example of all these grad students and lawyers and all these people in my book who switched careers. That's the minority. I mean, a lot of people who end up in kitchens, honestly, if they weren't, if they didn't become cooks, they might have just become like the town pot dealer. I mean, literally, I'm not even joking. A lot of these people were the pot dealer at their high school.
Right.
It's not a joke. I mean,
but
that's just a fact. But the contrast between what goes on in their lives and what goes on behind the door and then the beauty of what comes out on the plate, I think is so fascinating to me.
Yeah.
That the same person who's working in that circumstance, who very often came up in a very kind of hard scrabble existence, is capable of this. You use the word poet about Bianco, you know, this sort of poetry on the plate.
Yeah.
It's fascinating.
When you take on an assignment to write a chef's cookbook,
yeah,
what are you looking for? Because you must be, at this point, inundated. There's no shortage of people who want Andrew Friedman to write their book.
So
what do you look for? What are the signposts where you go, oh, yeah, I want to do this?
Well, first of all, thanks for the compliment. There's a lot more competition than there used to
be,
though.
Yeah, sure.
I have to tell you.
Yeah.
The most important thing for me, I tell people this straight up if they call me and say, I want to do a book, is a point of view. I tell people I cannot manufacture a point of view. If somebody comes to me and they, you know, there's this whole debate. It's been going on my own podcast for the last several two seasons, you know, whether or not cooking is an art or a craft. I think it's somewhere between the two, to be honest. But putting that aside, I cannot manufacture a point of view. If somebody's just coming to me with a collection of recipes, I can't help them. I mean, I could write the book, but I don't want to write that book. I've done too many books. It'll seem phoned in. I need something that's going to engage me. So that's priority one.
Mm-hmm.
Then I really need to feel like there's a chemistry. And I am often amazed where somebody will call me up and they just want to know how much it costs to hire me, you know? And I always say,
whoa.
Dude, you know, we gotta go out to dinner. We gotta go get a cocktail. We have to, you know, we gotta have some time together. How do you know we're gonna get along?
Right.
How do you know I'm gonna get you? How do I know I'm gonna get you? So there's that. Those are the two main things. And then I do at this point, you know, my greatest fear when I started doing this, and again, we don't need to name names, but I looked at the books out there by chefs, and I felt like there was this sort of equivalent of what people call journalese. Like there was a very kind of vanilla,
one-size-fits-all
collaborative style, which was just you were conveying the information, but there was no effort being made to get the personality of the chef on the page, right?
Yeah.
And to be honest, I ended up seeing that as a business opportunity for myself. And now I think that's much more normal that people try to do that in chef cookbooks. I told this to a young writer of mine a couple years ago. You probably know her. And very sarcastically, she said to me, oh, you invented voice. But I have to tell you, I'm sorry. Before I honestly go back pre-1997, 1998, it's the one thing I am a little pat myself on the back about. I don't feel like chef cookbooks ever sounded like the chef.
Yeah.
I really don't. I think that was.
Yeah.
So, but what I do now is I do try to sometimes find something new in the way of a subject matter or the chef themselves. Or, you know, a couple of years ago, I did a book with the guys at Battersby, and I really wanted that book. Why? Because they were barely 30, you know?
Right.
And I hadn't worked with anybody that young in a while.
Uh-huh.
You know, years ago, Michelle Bernstein and I were doing a phone interview, and she said, and I never met her at that point, she said, I love the way you're interviewing me. You know, can we talk about maybe doing a book? And I knew her by reputation, and I was interested, but I was also interested because I'd never ghosted for a woman before.
Yeah.
And I thought that would be interesting. So I live in fear. This is why I brought up this sort of journalese thing. I never want to be a hack, ever, for any job.
I always just say, I don't ever want to be bored.
Yeah, I never want to phone it in.
Yeah.
You know, and if I'm going to phone it in, you know, years ago, when he first came to New York, I think I can say this, and was at 11 Madison under Danny Meyer, I had an interview with Daniel Hum, okay? And I had just done a million cookbooks. I had just done the Chanterelle cookbook. And, you know, I went and had dinner there, and I met with him, and I thought he was great. And I remember saying to my agent at the time, I said, you know what? I'm burnt out right now. I can't do a book with component recipes from a chef at this level. It's not going to be fresh. I need a break. I need to step away. I need to go write some memoirs or do something with much more simple food. And I didn't pursue the opportunity. I don't know that he would have hired me, and he ended up not doing the book for like a decade. But I really try to be sensitive to that, because I feel like if someone's going to hire you to collaborate, especially if it's their first book, that is a sacred responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
A, you know, I've thought about this a lot writing this book I just wrote about a lot of chefs who aren't practicing anymore or who aren't with us anymore. you know, I think cookbooks are kind of the a chef's one real shot at immortality.
Yeah.
And if you are going to take that on, I think you really owe it to them to pour everything you've got into it, to not just take it as a job. And also from a business standpoint, as you know, if somebody gets saddled with lousy sales numbers on their first book, there's very little chance they'll get to do another book.
Yeah.
So you take
that responsibility.
I take it hugely seriously, and I've passed up on again, I don't know if I would have been offered them, but I've passed up on some big interviews even because I'm like, I'm not there right now. Yeah. This is not the time for me to do that.
Yeah. I mean, I would agree with you. I mean, I've only written two chef cookbooks, Tom Douglas in Seattle and Dave Pasternak from Esca. And so the voice thing obviously is something that I related to. And that's why I wanted to channel Dave Pasternak's voice and Tom Douglas's voice.
Yeah.
They had a really unique voice. And the third thing that you didn't mention that was really important to me was a story. I needed a narrative thread in my head. You know, like, and, you know, I've written two, you've written two dozen, but that was really important to me.
Yeah.
And
that makes sense.
And, you know, it's like, first of all, again, if I'm going to keep a reader interested, I've got to keep myself interested.
You know what's so funny? I'm a little ADD, and I always tell people, someone asks, like, what's your barometer for pacing and stuff, I always say, if I can stand to write it, I'm pretty sure someone will be able to read it.
Right, you know? Exactly.
Yeah.
So,
but did you know those two guys really well? Those jobs come about out of friendship?
Yes, they came out of friendship.
Yeah.
I had hired Tom Douglas when I put together a chef's consulting team for Northwest Airlines, and I got to know him, and I adore him, and he's one of my close friends today. You know,
great chef.
And Dave Pasternak was another person who I just got to know because he'd come out, right, and he'd tell you, oh yeah, this fish, like, we were in this inlet, it's not far from Long Beach, it's the only place you can get these, and these fish only eat, you know, tiny shrimp that only, you know, and it's just like, what?
Yeah.
And it was like, wow, like, this is amazing. And he had this Damon Runyon-esque, you know, delivery.
Yeah.
And so I was like, wow, this is like, I just want to channel this guy and write his story.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, the recipes were almost...
Look at you. You're all excited about it still.
I do. And I love Dave, and I still love Tom. They're both really... they are friends,
Can we just say, though, for any chefs who are listening to this, you need to find collaborators who are talking the way we're talking about you.
Yeah.
If you don't feel that from somebody, keep looking.
Yeah, that's true. I can't believe this, man. Like, we haven't even gotten to chefs, drugs, and rock and roll. So we're going to wrap up part one of the Andrew Friedman Chronicles. And plow on through to what will be part two. But for now, so long, serious eaters.